Hi, this is Rebecca Morta, founder and CEO of Loan Design Club, and welcome to our podcast, LDC Designer Stories. We will take you behind the scenes and into the world of our under-the-radar, cutting-edge, and conscious independent brands. We bring the designers to you, their stories, their processes, and inspiration. Get to know the real people behind these emerging next-generation brands. In this week's episode, we will be going on a journey into the conscious women's wear brand Birdsong. I'll be joined by co-founder Sophie Slater. Birdsong is a social enterprise, clothing for women who dress in protest. The brand is built deeply on purpose-driven, sustainable and ethical foundations, supporting women's rights, paying fair living wages, supporting underprivileged communities, and prioritizing people and planet. Okay, here we are. Sophie, it's great to have you in the studio. I'm super excited to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. Lovely to speak.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm just going to do my little fangirl moment. So I am wearing the Birdsong Optimist tee. I'm going to throw it out there. And I love it. And I bought it during the pandemic.
Thank you so much.
Love it. So look, thank you so much for being here. I'm super excited to have you on the show. We've obviously been working together now it was kind of at the beginning of the pandemic. It's been about 10 months. Mm-hmm. Kind of a crazy time to start working together. So I'm really excited to have you here and to get you in front of our listeners. And I think, you know, let's start off. Tell us a bit about Birdsong. How did you start the brand and what's the mission?
Yeah, sure. So we're a bit unusual in terms of like how we started. Our tagline is Dressing in Protest, which is a protest against, I guess it's like a rallying cry against the fashion industry as it is. And I think, you know, Loan Design Club does so much to champion small independent brands who are kind of going against the grain of the fashion industry at large. But, you know, as someone who, hard to believe it, I know, but when I was 15, I got scouted by a modelling agency. And that was kind of my first interaction with the fashion industry. And as someone who grew up in a little seaside town in the northeast, you know, like 300 odd miles away from London, it was incredibly exciting, but also kind of opened my eyes to, I guess, like, you know, especially in like the conversations we're definitely having this week in particular, like how quite creepy it was, how much kind of body policing there was, lack of diversity. You know, I'm like a white, cis, able-bodied woman, and, you know, I didn't feel good enough. I didn't feel, you know, it wasn't particularly like great for my self-esteem, even though you think, you know, as a teenage girl that would be dream come true. Was kind of made to feel like I was, you know, like didn't have the perfect body and stuff. So it kind of, I think when I had a little bit of an awakening, like a feminist awakening in the years afterwards, those previous experiences kind of, there was always like a bit of a rub, whereas I loved, you know, the creativity and the photography and the behind the scenes kind of camera stuff of the fashion industry. I've always loved clothes, always loved getting dressed. I've worked in retail since I was like 17, was working in vintage shops and in for a quite sexist ethical fashion brand that rhymes with American and Gapparel, as I said. So the combination of being, you know, scouted as a teenager and working as a shop assistant in for this particular brand, who again had some very strange practices around young women's bodies. It's interesting as well because they, for anyone who didn't know, they manufactured in the US. They played their factory workers kind of like a decent wage. They were very anti-sweatshop, and I had a good education in sweatshop kind of labour working there. But at the same time, there was this disconnect between how they were treating their women staff and the women in their advertising. And, all these kind of experiences crystallised, this love of fashion, but, like, not with the way it was operating in the world in terms of, like, you know, 80% of sweatshop workers are women. I studied history at university and actually I felt it like at the time I was just kind of picking random bits of history that I found interesting. But I think looking back, I studied a lot of queer history. I studied a lot of labour movements. And I studied a lot about colonialism. And looking at, you know, the fact that 80% of garment workers are brown women, brown working class women in the global south, who the West is kind of using as a colonial kind of, I don't know, Slow Factory did this amazing seminar the other day about it, and there's kind of like digital colonialism, like, and like when you're kind of outsourcing digital labor, for example, from like places like India, and then there's like all these different forms of colonialism, which we think isn't still a thing, but it massively is. And I couldn't reconcile my love of the fashion industry with the way it was operating, so I kind of had a bit of an odd route into fashion, in that it started as a social enterprise, like first and foremost. So I went completely away from fashion and I started working in women's organisations. I was working like a rape crisis centre, I was working with homeless women in my early career, and basically was trying to find women's organisations that could support the women I was working with. And we were doing quite a lot of craft because it's really meditative, it's quite like healing, really takes your mind off things, obviously, if you're dealing with like a lot of stuff, which the women I was working with in homelessness were. And I was ringing around all these different women's organisations in London saying, like, is there a crafting programme we can get, you know, these women onto? Because a lot had kind of worked, knew how to sew really well, or it was something they really wanted to get into, or maybe they'd done like an access course in like prison. And all the women's organisations I spoke to were like, these are exactly the kind of women we should be reaching out to and working with, but we're just completely slammed. Like, we haven't got any money, we can't do any outreach. So we kind of did a bit of research, and there were quite a few women's organisations supporting women who were a little bit more stable and were making beautiful things and trying to sell them. But again, they were so separate to the fashion industry. You know, there's like the women's group that my business partner at the time was working with were a group of older women at a day centre who were just knitting for the sake of it because they love knitting, and like they would just sell it at a bring and buy sale or knit something amazing and then give it to a charity shop because it gave them like a sense of purpose. And they were still worrying about, like, fretting about the future of their day centre and whether we were going to have enough money to restore the carpets and things. So it started off as a project, actually, to be like, okay, well, if you knit us a couple of scarves, we'll put them online because you're terrified of selling online. You've never tried it, which is understandable. And we'll see if we can raise some money for the day centre. And that's basically how it started.
Wow.
With some very
that's amazing.
Lumpy, ununiform scarves. With very unsustainable wool from Wilko's around the corner from the day centre, and kind of evolved into working with lots more women's organisations and hiring our amazing talented designer Susanna Wen, and, you know, sourcing much more responsible kind of sustainable fabrics. But yeah, it's interesting, we've kind of got a bit full circle. It was always kind of made to order, it was always small batch, it was always you know, really relating to who's made this item and the origins of it, and showing kind of garment worker's skill and craft and who that person is. And we've gone back to made to order. So, even if the Wilko's wool wasn't the most sustainable, at least we were kind of not producing en masse. So,
And it was made, you know, by love and by these incredible women, which is just, you know, and that purpose behind it is amazing. I had no idea that's how you got started.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's a bit unconventional.
So how, no, but that's, you know, the most amazing things often come from, you know, from unconventional. You were really reacting to something, which is so amazing. And, you know, that purpose that was driving you. So how... take us back a little bit further. So you, because you have a co-founder, right?
Yeah. So
so how did you guys meet, or how did it all kind of become involved?
Yeah, so my co-founder, who I founded from the start, she's actually gone on to start a family now. But Susanna Wen joined us, how many years ago?
Okay, maybe
4 years ago, and she designs all the collections. Yeah. And so we started in 2014 originally. Me and Sarah, who were the original founders. And I'd, again, completely off piece, like, I thought I was so over fashion, like, I looked close, but I'd actually applied to a master's in social policy and like statistics, something to do with statistics. It was really dry. It was really, really dry at University of Oxford, and got in, which I was really excited about, but then couldn't actually afford the fees. So quickly, and you're not allowed to defer and stuff. So kind of took a little bit of a chance and instead applied to this weird experimental postgrad course in London that had no fees attached through like an advert, which sounds like really dodgy. I think I got like the mega bus down and went for this interview and met these two blokes in a coffee shop and was like, yeah, cool, this sounds like quite interesting. Because it was like the company's called Year Here, and now like,
okay,
this amazing transformative educational experience. They've got a pastoral team, they've got an office, they've got, you know, you can get like bursaries and stuff. It's really fantastic. But it was really in its infancy when I did it. There was only 9 of us.
Wow.
And it was incredible. And I was really lucky in that I had a best mate in London who had a futon in a cornered off section of the living room that I was allowed to stay on for about 6 months. And I moved to London from Manchester, where I was studying at the time, and did this experimental postgrad in social innovation. And that's where I was kind of starting to work with, I'd already been working in women's services, but I was working with homeless women. This is where my business partner started working at the day centre, kind of trying to problem solve frontline, you know, organisation problems with kind of a business solution, which I guess is, you know, the core principles of like a social enterprise. And it was funny because when I started, I was like, oh, I do not want to start a business. Like, for me, the idea of starting a business was like, I don't know, I feel like there was so few, I didn't really know what it entailed. Like, I didn't know anyone who'd had their own business growing up, really. You know, I thought it was just Richard Branson or nothing, you know, like,
that's a great way to go into it, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been quite creative. Like, I used to make like little feminist theory like zines at university and like sell them online, and I used to put punk bands on and like feminist bands, and surprisingly those are the skills that were probably the most useful from my degree in terms of like starting a creative business. But I never went into it thinking I'm gonna start a fashion brand. That was like,
yeah.
And it is, you know, it's that thing that it would have been my dream job. Like, I always wanted to go to art school. I always wanted to work in fashion. But as I said, I was kind of like, well, you know, politically, I can't align with myself with it. And I don't know where to start or if I've got the experience. So I kind of have arrived at my dream job. It was just a very roundabout way of doing it. So, yeah, we basically had a 6-week project where we could start our own business. And yeah, so this is when we started working with the older women, making the scarves. And there was, I think there was like a 48-hour period where we did this terrible logo on like Microsoft Paint, which is like now defunct. I'm really showing my age here. And like, what did we do? Oh yeah, we went to this women's organisation on Brick Lane, who have sadly had their funding cut, so they had to shut down. But there was this incredible grassroots organisation on Brick Lane, of these seamstresses who'd been kind of working in the area for like 30 years. And they made these beautiful clothes, but they were selling at Spitalfields and the market had really changed. There's all these chain restaurants, they were really struggling. So we reached out to them and we were like, how about we try and sell your clothes like online? Because it's a lot less effort for you. We'll like give you the same price, but we'll just add a fee on top. So we picked these clothes up from this women's organisation. So, like, did a market store down Camden Market that day, packed up at 4 o'clock. My business partner got her ex-boyfriend's camera. I rang my mate, John, who's this, like, gorgeous, like, model-esque, like, really interesting, like, non-binary friend of mine who's modelled from us from the start, actually. They still model for us. This is, like, 6-7 years ago. And we did a photo shoot in the park, like, really impromptu. And then that night I went home, downloaded all the pictures, got a Shopify website up, and then we launched it the next day. And that was it. That was Birdsong. And, like, you know, you look back and you cringe so much, but I think that course was really valuable because they taught us just to kind of get everything out really quickly, test things, you know, write the copy really quickly, get feedback. And as soon as we were doing it, we were like, this is incredible. Like, this is what we want to be doing. Like, I feel like this is really exciting. And I think, especially, you know, in 2014, it was 18 months after the Rana Plaza collapse. Fashion Revolution had just kind of started campaigning around that. It was just a day then. It wasn't like a week.
Yeah.
And yeah, I knew we were onto something because I knew that people were, you know, this is at the time where it was still considered quite radical to not airbrush models, because that's what our first press was around, the fact that our models had stretch marks and armpit hair, and it wasn't even intentional at the time. It was just like, well, I have those things. Like, I think especially as like a queer person, you're like, I didn't even really see it. I was a bit blind to the fact that, like, you know, those were even points of conversation. So then when we got loads of press about the fact we had models with hairy armpits and stretch marks, I was like, well, I guess it was intentional, but not in the way you think it was. It wasn't like a conscious decision. It was like, well, yeah, they're my friends and they're beautiful. Why would I Photoshop? And also, I can't Photoshop. I can't use Photoshop. I'm like 23 and I just started a business with no idea what I'm doing. So I can't even talk to Adobe Suite at the time. Like, you know, I can use InDesign now, but at the time it was Microsoft Paint or nothing. So
that is amazing. And I think that's great. Tell me a little bit about the designs then. You know, we've spoken a bit about dress and protest, you know, the support that you're giving for these women's charities, which is absolutely incredible. And I want to definitely dive deeper into this in a bit. But how do you bring through the protest and the activism in the designs you do? Because each of them, you know, they're so beautiful. I mean, I love the embroidery. Like, obviously, I'm wearing the Optimist tee now, and it means a lot. And it makes me feel a certain way when I wear it. But how are you approaching the design of it? What is the messaging or the motivation behind each of the designs that you're putting out?
That's really interesting. So me and Sue's work really well as a team, actually. She does all the cut and sew. And I think a lot of it starts from, like, how we want to feel and how we want our customers to feel. So, like, you know, little things like making pockets and things so that it's practical, and doing up to a size 30 and kind of fit testing. And there's been loads of instances, you know, where we've made a top and then people have reached out and been like, oh, as like a working mum, like, when I lift things up, this top comes up a bit short, could you make the tops a bit longer? So we've like factored that into our design rules, and we kind of, you know, build them up as we go along. But I think, you know, we've always kind of labored under the message that people deserve really beautiful things. They deserve things that last, that are kind of functional and beautiful and really joyous. And I think, like, I kind of mainly design the t-shirts, which are unisex and a little bit kind of like more accessible at price point. And I think a lot of the designs behind that, I guess because the idea behind that was, you know, there's so many feminist slogan tees, but they're not actually kind of really giving back to communities who make them, or, you know, the women who make them. So we work with this woman called Mona, who's a sewing teacher on a housing estate, and she embroiders them on a machine, and we pay like above living wage for her to do that. And I think, yeah, with the t-shirts, it's always kind of statements about optimism and hopefulness. And I think one of my favorite ever quotes that inspired the Optimist t-shirt was this Italian philosopher Gramsci, who says, pessimism of intellect, optimism of will. So, you know, acknowledging how hard and horrible the place, like the world, can be, and the state of things really realistically, but always being optimistic that you can make things a little bit better. And I think in terms of like sustainability, that is the perfect message. I went to see Angela Davis speak a few years ago, and she quoted him as well, like, in her talk, and I just thought that was so perfect. I thought we had to make a t-shirt out of it. Because it is that, you know, things aren't great, you know, in terms of, like, you know, look at the policing bill that they're just about to, you know, try and pass through Parliament, or if you look at sustainability, or if you look at, you know, Black Lives Matter, like, the state of things isn't great, but people are working really, really hard to try and progress that. And I think there's a really fine line when you're a sustainable brand who's talking about protest and talking about wanting better conditions for people, because a lot of the fashion industry, unfortunately, is, you know, based on really depressing, you know, like slave labor, and, you know, look at cotton coming out of the Uyghur concentration camps and that kind of thing. But people have got to have hope and they've got to have joy. And I think we try and lead by example. And I think, you know, there's loads of campaigning groups who do fantastic jobs of like educating people. And it's always that really fine line of education and not wanting to bum people out. And I think the best way to do that is to be a really shining example and a blueprint of fashion that can feel really good and look really fun and be gorgeous. Yeah. And you can be wearing something that's made for living wages and done in the least kind of hopefully harmful way and have massive puff sleeves and have fun with it. So I think that's like the philosophy behind a lot of our designs, is that it's not taking itself too seriously. I think as well, I really love the femininity of our designs, because I think like we need to do a photo shoot around this. Actually, we've not been able to shoot much at all this year, but I find it really interesting that people say, you know, when brands are unisex or when they're kind of more gender inclusive, they automatically are quite masculine. And I feel like
interesting.
Yeah, I really want to do a shoot actually with people of all genders wearing our clothes, because I think everyone should be able to wear a puff sleeve.
Definitely. I think your pieces, they're amazing, because anyone can wear them and they're so easily translatable. And like you said, I love what you said earlier about, the designs are inspired by feelings or mood. And I think that's so important. I definitely put this t-shirt on thinking, you know, optimism and the colors and everything comes together. Which is amazing. But okay, so I've got two questions. So I'm gonna say them together, because I feel like I keep thinking of questions and then just like we, you know, carry on and I'm like, oh no.
Sorry, I talk too much. I go on and on and on.
No, you don't. You've got great stories and I love hearing the little stories. But tell us, because the two things I'm interested in. One side, tell us a little bit more about how you work with women's groups now. You've mentioned Mona, which is fantastic, but what are your policies or what is your mission here? What are you trying to achieve by the way that you're working with communities and women's groups? And then on the other side of the question, what does sustainability mean to you? I think this is interesting. Everyone has a slightly different interpretation. The word is a buzzword. It can mean various things, but I think you have such an incredible purpose behind Birdsong. I'm really interested to know how you quantify or qualify sustainability and what it means to you, Birdsong, and the ultimate vision.
Absolutely. I think, you know, sustainability is such a buzzword, and, you know, public literacy around sustainability relies a lot on what bigger brands kind of say as well. So I think for us, a smaller brand, it's really interesting because we've been such a small team that we don't have all these policies in writing a lot of the time. And I'm just doing that because we're about to become a B Corporation, which is like a really good certification. I say about to be, we'll see how long it takes us because we're a really small team. I think, well, basically we have it, you know, enshrined in our company articles that we are a social enterprise first and foremost. So that means planet and people above profit. And obviously we need to make profit to keep going. But we are here with the sole purpose to create a blueprint for a better fashion industry and to create like living wage income for women's organisations and charities that need it. And that is our core mission, basically. So I think sustainability for us, ethics has always been like the big one. Like we only want to work, we don't work with factories. We work with like really small grassroots workshops where women can wander about, have a cup of tea, chat with their mates. Like, it's not a factory. They're not on an assembly line. There's not, like, you know, people shouting at them. People are treated with respect. Like, we only work with people, like, with charities and organisations that foster, like, a working environment that we ourselves would want to be in. And I think, like, that is the main definition. And unfortunately, that's quite unusual in the fashion industry. It shouldn't be. That should be the bare minimum. And I think, for us, ethics and sustainability is really intertwined because, you know, you can make something out of 100% recycled fabric, like we do a lot of the time. But if you're making 3 billion of those, it's not sustainable. Unless, like, I don't know, you're swapping it for something else. But, like, I think it's about volume, and that's why we think pre-order is a really good way to be sustainable, because, you know, not everyone can dress secondhand or vintage. You know, we, that's why we make up to a size 30, and, you know, things do wear out, things do need replacing, especially if you're plus size, it's really, really hard to get that stuff like secondhand. But yeah, I think it's about being really mindful of everything. So, you know, like thinking about the effects that your clothing has from cradle to grave, basically. And
yeah,
I think when you put more money into environmental and social change than you do into your marketing budget, then maybe you can call yourself sustainable. But yeah, it'd be really interesting to know like what proportion of like massive brands are spending on advertising campaigns to say they're sustainable, and like what proportion are they actually putting into, you know, recycling garments or paying living wages, for example, because we know 98% at least, probably more like 99% of brands don't pay living wages. So
interesting. And just on the note of greenwashing, I mean, do you, because I think this is a really difficult, it's a really tricky word, and unfortunately we've got to a point, especially through the pandemic, where everyone's on this jumping on this bandwagon. Like you said, there's a lot of money going into advertising campaigns. We're conscious, we're sustainable, but it, I think it's really difficult and it's really overwhelming for a consumer or for a shopper to understand or to know. You know, they're taking a brand's word for it, and unfortunately the advertising is often, oh, they said they are, therefore they are, I can buy it. Do you have, I mean, how do you navigate that, you know, as a smaller brand? Like, what would you look for, what would your advice be to customers or to anyone that is feeling a little overwhelmed or trying to understand what actually is good and what is a clear sign of greenwashing? Or not that they're always clear, but I guess how would you navigate that?
Totally, it's so difficult. And if you don't follow Slow Factory, who are an incredible educational charity run by like Black, Indigenous, people of colour educators who have loads of free resources on like sustainable and ethic kind of literacy. They're amazing to look into if you really want to take a deep dive. Fashion Revolution are an incredible organisation. But I think a lot of brands do a really good job of being like, here's our factory, here's a picture of our factory, we use sustainable fabrics, which, you know, looks great. But then you, I think the main questions to ask, and if you can't find this information, then they're probably not ethical and sustainable, is how much their workers paid. And I think that's like the main one, really, because we tend to think of sustainability and ethics as separate, but the only reason garment workers are paid poverty wages is because of the sheer volume of clothes they're being to make, like being forced to make. So you can't really have one without the other. You don't really get the overproduction and the like cutting corners and the like oversaturation of clothing. Yeah, and anyone using kind of like raw polyester, which is just plastic, obviously.
Yeah,
that's a massive one as well, I think. I mean, if, even if they've got like a conscious line or a conscious, you know, garment, like what's the rest of the collection made of?
On the note of materials, actually, I feel like there's a lot of talk at the moment about circular economy and how, you know, as opposed to creating more materials and fabric, how can it be more recycled or repurposed or, you know, brought back into that circular loop? Do you, are you guys seeing anything? Or are you looking at doing anything in this sphere to, I guess, close that loop so that we're not just, you know, constantly creating? I mean, I know we're in infancy here when it comes to materials and sustainability, but I don't know. Are you guys seeing anything or planning anything? Or what are your thoughts on that kind of closing that loop circular in the circular economy sphere?
Absolutely. We're thinking about it all the time. And we use a lot of reclaimed fabrics. We use like a bunch of recycled, but we also use a lot of raw organic cotton and Tencel. And it's really complicated, the whole conversation, because organic cotton might be amazing for one group of farmers and their livelihood. And it might really invigorate their soil and actually be a really good thing to keep that kind of culture going and to keep their livelihoods. Yeah. But then when you've got like loads of brands using organic cotton, then it becomes a monoculture, and as we know, that's like bad for soil health. and pushes, like, creates more competition, maybe, like, you know, what we're seeing in India with the farmers' protests and things. It's really, really complicated, and I think that's why traceability is so important. But yeah, apart from using recycled and reclaimed fabrics, I've been really lucky that I've sat on all parliamentary group sessions, you know, urging MPs to put more funding into fabric recycling, because at the minute, you know, we've got local councils, some local councils recycle textiles, but most of it is used for like rag or insulation. We don't actually have much of like an infrastructure in the UK to recycle our textiles here. And that's something that we should massively be invested in, and that's why I kind of veer off into politics a lot of the time, and I talk about the Green New Deal and why we need infrastructure in order to make the British fashion industry more green, because especially with Brexit, you know, we need to be able to have, we produce so many clothes here, we need to have our own kind of fabric sources as well, to encourage brands to be a bit more circular and a little bit more, I don't know, it would make, you know, the supply chain more transparent as well, because there'd be a source of fabrics we could get here. But yeah, and then there's other things, you know, like extending the life cycle of clothing, which I think is really important and part of that circularity loop as well. So you're not just thinking about, you know, recycling all those fabrics, but you're thinking about where it goes on the way to, you know, hopefully. And that's another thing as well, you know, recycled polyester, that's a kind of good option, but then also where does it go after that, you know? Because we've got so much polyester already in the world, we won't use any new polyester, but then it's still unrecyclable at the end. There's only so many times you can recycle it. At least with raw and virgin materials, they tend to be more biodegradable. So there's always like pluses and cons in every single sustainable conversation. And something that I'm really excited to be working on actually is another brand, Sancho's Dress, who are based in Exeter, who just won Holly Tucker's High Street Shop of the Year. They're incredible.
Amazing.
They do their own brand stuff, but they're also like a, you know, like a marketplace kind of shop for loads of other ethical and sustainable brands. Their founder has been working on this new platform where brands like Birdsong can sell secondhand items at a slightly lower price. And we can track the life cycle of that garment through its life, through like a digital wardrobe, and then gather data and design, you know, if for example we're designing dresses and the armpit comes undone on each one, we can know to reinforce that and extend its life a little bit more. Or if people are getting rid of their clothes because they don't fit as well after they've put a few pounds on, maybe we can make a bit more of a seam allowance. Like, I think that's a really interesting way to design as well. Longevity.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so looking at the kind of resale, kind of re-commerce side of this as well. So would you then encourage customers to bring the pieces, or I guess sell them back to you to sell on, or it would be kind of peer-to-peer thing?
Yeah, it's peer-to-peer. It's called Schwap, and it's going to be really exciting. It's peer-to-peer, but the brand can get like a 10% commission, which is great, because I think actually brands need to be incentivized to resale. They need to be incentivized to think about where their clothes are going out into the world, you know, it's not just our responsibility to sell something and then kind of rub our hands like free of it. I think like we need to think about what's happening to the clothes that we've already put into the world and how they're going about in their life cycle.
Definitely. Okay, amazing. Okay, so we're kind of around just over 30 minutes. So I'm going to just do, I think, one or two last kind of questions. So tell us a little bit about how the pandemic has been for you guys. You know, it's been obviously up and down for everyone, chaos, but also hopefully some opportunity. You know, I've seen so much from you guys as well on social. So tell us a little bit about how the past kind of, I guess, a year now, how that's been.
It's been so interesting. I mean, this time last year, we just switched to a pre-order model, which in hindsight, we had no idea. It was so interesting, actually, because we were like really nervous to launch this pre-order model. We'd done a crowdfunder to kind of test it 6 months before this. And we were like, well, people are going to have to wait like 2 or 3 weeks for their dress. Will they be prepared to wait that long? you know, on the one hand, if we talk about how sustainable it is, and it's good just that things are only being made if they're wanted, and also because our seamstresses are based in London, you know, it's still only 2 to 3 weeks, which is quite, you know, a short amount of time. But we were really, really nervous because it was quite unusual at that time to have to wait for something. And then the pandemic hit literally 2 weeks later. And then these customers ended up waiting 6 months for their dresses because all our seamstresses, you know, we did quite a bit of campaigning around the BAME COVID report because, you know, Tower Hamlets, which is the borough that we predominantly work in, home to a lot of mostly like Bengali working class women that we work with, and they were twice as at risk from COVID mortality than like the white population. And you know, even without that stat, the charities that we work with, their number one priority is obviously to keep the women safe above everything else. So it wasn't even an option. Like, we knew that workshop was gonna have to shut down for at least like, you know, 3 months. And we did things like making fabric face coverings that the women could make from home, which is a really useful way to be able to support them during that time. Our embroiderer actually got stuck in Egypt, so we had to do like a fundraiser to get her back, which was really, you know, stressful, but really glad that we got her back safe. So there's a lot of adapting to that, but I think it was really interesting because we were so worried about, will people have the patience to wait for their made to order? Will people understand that our workshops are shut down for 3 months? Because obviously our workers' welfare is the most important thing, whereas other ones were still shipping and all that kind of thing. But there were some real positives that came out of it, I think. Like, we started a Patreon account in order for people to be able to support us. And I think also, you know, we know things like, you know, there's been reports since 2018, I think, that factory workers in Leicester were earning £3.50 an hour. And it was in the governmental select committee report. So the government knew about it too. But then last summer it got widespread press, you know, attention. It's really interesting. So I remember saying to someone on the panel years ago, you know, most workers in Leicester get paid £3.50 an hour. And they were like, I don't believe you. That's not true. But now we know. everyone knows now. So yeah, it was really interesting. I think a lot of our customers really, or a lot of new customers really engaged with us on like the social messages and what we were doing. And that was really exciting. And it was a really stressful time, obviously. Like, we were really worried about all our makers. Our warehouse is staffed by people with learning disabilities and autism, and a lot of people who work there have kind of pre-existing health conditions, so the warehouse staff had to go home. So we were packing out t-shirts ourselves for a couple of weeks in the summer. I think it's an interesting one. I think, you know, we had our best year yet in terms of sales. I think, you know, all e-commerce brands kind of saw a bit of a boost because everyone was at home. But I do think, like, it's interesting because I think there's been a lot of content that we wanted to talk about in the past, but it wasn't really quite the right time because you kind of got to meet people where they're at in terms of their understanding. And, you know, we did a post about slow shopping, which is like thinking, do you really want this? And like, do you want this because you're having a bad day or your self-esteem feels a bit bad? Or do you want this because it's a really beautiful item that will make your life better? I think we would have been a bit too scared to put something like that out like a few years ago. Because we would have been like, well, it's going to de-incentivize people to shop, or like, people won't get it. But people, you know, really love that message. And I think it's given us an opportunity to be a bit more radical with our messaging, I think, and say things that we maybe would have worried about saying before, in regards to like garment workers' rights. I think, you know, it's a year to be upfront, I think, and a year to hold people accountable. You know, there's been incredible activism. When you think about all the work that, you know, Black Lives Matter have done, all the work that garment workers in Myanmar are doing at the minute to protest against the military coup, you know, I think we owe it to, you know, we owe it to hold the powers that be accountable, I think, and that includes, you know, the fashion industry, absolutely.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think what you just said is amazing as well. You know, this is the year to be upfront and hold people accountable. You could not have said it better. I completely agree. Fascinating. Okay, look, last question, and then I promise we're gonna wrap up. So I feel like that was such a great way to end, but I'm gonna ask one more.
So slow descent into like absolute political rant.
No, but so interesting and so important for now. I think that's it's fantastic. So let's end. Give us what is the vision? You know, what do you want to see for Birdsong in the next kind of 5+ years? What is your mission? What do you want to do with the brand?
We've got so many kind of like out there ideas, and I think like this has been a really heartbreakingly hard, terrible year, maybe like 10 years for a lot of people. And I think with the hardest, you know, circumstances is always like a really encouraging opportunity for transformation as well. I think there's like a Rebecca Solnit quote that we did at the beginning of the pandemic about kind of the transformative qualities of tragedy. I think, mm-hmm. you know, looking at Brexit, looking at the climate crisis, looking at the landscape for people of colour, black people, women and girls, I think we've got an opportunity to really re-envision fashion as something less exploitative and fairer. Mm-hmm. And I want to see a fashion industry that gives back to local communities. I think, like, my dream would be to kind of have, not necessarily under the Birdsong name, but to have like a local high street shop that is staffed by really talented seamstresses in the area, where they could potentially make our designs and use our prints, and you could go and get a dress fitted to your body shape in whatever town you're in, and amazing. It would last you. And I think maybe that's a bit ambitious for like 5 years, but
I feel like we could make that happen. Happen for you. I will chat with Alice.
Amazing. I want to be able to go back to my little hometown, and instead of like whatever fast fashion they've got there, just for everyone to be able to like maybe pay for it. Because this is going back to, you know, how my mum used to shop when she was a kid, you know, like she grew up in poverty, but they had one beautiful outfit a year that fit, that kept them warm, that they paid off throughout the year, and then they'd hand it down to the next sister because she was one of six. And I think like going back to that idea of like really local tailored, long-lasting beautiful fashion. And I don't think sustainable fashion shouldn't be elitist. It shouldn't be this thing that only rich people get to afford, and you know, wages are so stagnant for the past 20 years that unfortunately it is at the minute. But I think everyone deserves beautiful things. Everyone should be able to shop at LDC. Everyone should be able to afford something really sustainable and gorgeous.
I totally agree. Yeah. I agree. And I think that's one of the things that you guys are definitely doing with Birdsong, which is amazing. That accessibility. That's fantastic. Look, Sophie, thank you so much. This has been a incredible conversation. I feel like I've learned a lot as well. Which I love. But thank you so much for joining me today. It's been absolutely amazing.
Thank you so much. Thank you for letting me rant on.
No, your rant's been great. And for anyone listening, do go to the website, check out the Birdsong collection. You can find it at loandesignclub.com/collection/birdsong. There are some beautiful pieces on the site, the tees, and also a beautiful ready-to-wear collection. So go have a little nosy, have a little browse. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you at the next episode.